Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Ben Michaelis. Dr. Michaelis and I will be discussing about his latest book titled Your Next Big Thing, 10 Small Steps to Get Moving and Get Happy. Dr. Michaelis will be sharing strategies on how to move forward without fear so that you can achieve joy, passion, and the enriched life you never thought possible. Good morning, Dr. Michaelis. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Wonderful. Your Next Big Thing is an awesome book. It is very well written, and I strongly recommend it as a must-read for people who are truly seeking to make a permanent change. And what I like about the book as well is the fact that the added bonus of having the stories you have included in the book clearly serve as wonderful inspiration. So congratulations.
Thanks so much, Johnny. Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, you know, I grew up in a household where education was very, very much prized. Both of my parents were public school teachers throughout their careers. And they really encouraged my sister and I to, you know, spend a lot of our time and energy getting educated, and that was a real focus. And then the other thing that I discovered along the way was how important not just education in a traditional sense is, but also self-education and being out there and living life. And one of the major influences for me was, you know, being involved in the dramatic arts throughout high school, throughout college, and in many ways, and as you and I were talking about, the best education in some ways I've had was when I was just out on my own. I decided to spend some time climbing the mountains in India for the better part of a year in my early 20s. And in many ways, those experiences, getting to meet all sorts of different folks, were the formative experiences of my life.
Interesting. You were on the voyage of self-discovery. I mean, you traveled to the Middle East as well. So I imagine you were experiencing epiphanies left and right.
Yeah, I mean, when you're alone and you really have, you know, just yourself to you know, I was literally with a bag on my back. You learn so much about yourself when you're out there in the world. You know, there's an expression that I know Dr. Martin Luther King said, which was basically the measure of a man is not when he's in his home, but when he's out in the world. Mm-hmm. And those experiences, getting to meet different people and sometimes just literally sleeping out under the stars. A few times while I was traveling, I actually stayed in people's barns.
Mm-hmm.
Those experiences were formative and influenced my work as a clinical psychologist to this day.
That brings us to, why did you decide to pursue the study of psychology?
You know, people often don't recognize that the word psychology is, you know, it's the study of the soul. That's where its origins are. And while I was out traveling, you know, those sorts of experiences, getting to know different people, inspired me to want to just to learn more. And every time I took a course in psychology, I came out feeling inspired, whether it was psychology, developmental psychology, or abnormal psychology, or social psychology. It really inspired me to want to learn more. And I'll tell you, I draw on the lessons from classes that I took as an undergraduate to this day, you know, and and really, it is the study of the soul. And a lot of times that gets lost in a lot of the research that's done and the numbers and all of that. But but it's fundamentally about trying to help people live better and happier and more fulfilling lives.
Very, very interesting. So how did the book, The Next Big Thing, come about?
You know, in a sort of like I live my life in a haphazard way in many ways. as I was, so I work in Manhattan, and I live in Brooklyn, which for anyone out there that's listening in Brooklyn or hasn't been to Brooklyn, I really feel so fortunate to live there. It is the best place I've ever lived in my life. There's such a wonderful sense of community there. It's extremely diverse. And so in my commuting, I take the subway in. I started making notes about things that were working with different patients. And I really didn't have a plan to write a book. I just was jotting notes down. And then on Christmas, about 4 years ago, I was sitting in my in-law's house and with all these notes, and I was like, you know what? This could really be a book. And so I forged it all together, and then went about, it's very backwards in many ways, went about trying to find someone to publish it. But it was not like the standard process whereby you make a proposal and then try to sell that. It was literally like I kind of wrote the book and then found people to publish it.
Right. Well, the book is very exciting. As I mentioned to you, it's a must-read for people who really wants to make a permanent change. One of the things that I get from the book is that in reading it, it's not just necessarily about you putting all your thoughts in there from a standpoint, well, hey, you have a PhD, you've learned, you've read so many books, and you're trying to condense everything down. This is the knowledge that I've gained, and I'm sharing this with you. But what's more important about the book is that this is something that you have gone through and lived yourself over the years, and it's a wonderful combination of educational knowledge that you've got, including living knowledge that you have encountered over the years, and it's all summarized down to this next big thing, and you're sharing this with other people. So for that, once again, congratulations for doing that.
Thank you. Thanks. And, you know, it really does feel like, you know, sort of a culmination of this part of my journey. Mm-hmm. And so, one of the chapters in Your Next Big Thing is called Share Yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe the idea of sharing is critical for anyone's journey. Giving to other people, and it doesn't necessarily mean, resources in terms of, you know, physical resources or money. Sharing can be done in all sorts of different ways, including hope or knowledge. Those are all ways that we can share with each other. And when we share our own experiences with other people, they're enriched and we are enriched. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel fortunate to be able to share this with other people.
Wonderful. What is the main ingredient in the next big thing?
I'd say that the one major main ingredient in your next big thing is play. And when I've been doing some studying about sort of the cross-cultural literature, mm-hmm. anthropological literature on play. And, Johnny, play is something that exists in every single culture known to humanity throughout time. Play is one of these things that's universal. And it is the way that we move forward as children. If you've ever seen, you know, spent time with a young child that's trying to go through a difficult experience like the birth of a new sibling or something like that, mm-hmm. if you spend any time with them, what they're doing is they're playing. They're trying to make sense of an experience that is inherently frightening. And if we can take that sense of play and bring it into our own experiences as adults, that really is the key element of this book, is sort of teaching people as adults how to tap back into that natural sense of play.
I noticed that a whole lot, in the sense that sometimes too, when you play, we're talking about a different sets of chemical that is going through your body as well. You have a different sort of demeanor when you do that, don't you?
Absolutely. And the way when we're truly playing, we're very much present. We're in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times when we're struggling with things, we all sort of tend to leave the moment. We're absent because if we're struggling, then we potentially are in a great deal of pain and we don't want to experience that head on. And so there's a tendency to leave. But when we're playing, we're very much present. And we work through a lot of things just naturally by our sense of exploring new possibilities. And one of the most difficult things when we're stuck is a tendency to look down and in just to sort of get through.
Right.
And when we're playing and we're imagining new horizons, it's really about bringing our eyes up and out. And that's really what play is all about. And again, that's the central part of your next big thing.
Interesting. The stories shared in the book are about people who came to a point in their lives when they have to decide as to where they want or need to go in life. How important it is for us to come to that realization?
It's truly essential. Everyone does this in their own way and in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cannot rush someone to have this realization. Everyone needs to come to their own time. And people come to it at very different points in their chronological lives. But we all do need to have a sense of purpose. And that's one of the other big things in your next big thing is living a life that is based on principles that are larger than just you. And purpose can be all sorts of different things. It can mean family. It can mean romantic love. It can mean spirituality. It can mean, all sorts of different things. But in everyone's lives, they need to come to the recognition that they need to have a purpose in order to move forward in life.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What are the 10 steps to get from the now you to the new you, which I like, by the way, you classify it from the standpoint of this is who I am now and that's where I want to be.
Absolutely. The 10 steps, and you appropriately grounded it in the now.
Yeah.
The first step is knowing yourself. Whenever you begin a journey, and just to be clear, every single journey begins with some degree of crisis. Because if you don't have a crisis, why would you go on the journey to begin with?
Yeah.
You just stay where you were. And so at the beginning of the journey, step number one is know yourself. And that really involves you just taking stock of where you are in your life, taking some time to consider how you got here. And in the book, in Your Next Big Thing, the way I break it out is helping people with very concrete exercises to learn about their roles, the roles they play in their daily lives, the values they hold, and the things in their lives that bring them joy. In order to, you have to know who you are before you can know where you want to go. And that's really step one, is just know yourself. And the next step is really where we bring in the concept of play. And step two is just called imagine yourself. And in this step, we really talk about rediscovering your innate sense of play and learning how to use your imagination in order to envision a new horizon for you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, play. I introduced a number of different concepts in this chapter about play tools and play space. So making sure that you have the opportunity and the space to imagine a new horizon. Step number three involves, again, discovering your purpose. And this is where we connect you with your core values in order to develop a personal statement of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And this personal statement of purpose becomes a key part of the rest of the book. It involves you writing what's important to you and how you want to live your life in 100 words or less. And because once you know what's truly important to you, the rest of the journey is really, or the next part of the journey is really just about taking action. So that statement of purpose, which is, again, a major part of step three, is really a key for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And key for the process. The next step, which is called face your inner critic, as you envision a new life for yourself, everyone has a voice inside of them that wants to keep them safe but confined.
Mm-hmm.
And in this part of the book, we really learn about where this voice comes from for each of us and how to face it in order to move forward. I really fundamentally believe that since every human being is born with an instinct for self-preservation, that's not just a drive to survive. It's a drive to thrive and to believe in ourselves and our own possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're all born as optimists. But throughout the process of socialization, we start to develop other parts of us, including a voice that often wants to keep us safe but confined. And that really is the voice of the inner critic, which tends to emerge right when we're about to take action, which is why I put it at this point in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And step number five is entitled Take Action, and it's really all about getting over the initial barriers to taking action, because I think that the first steps are often the hardest steps when we're feeling stuck. Once we start getting moving, things get easier. But this whole chapter is dedicated to techniques in order to overcome inertia, in order to get the time and space to get you moving.
Mm-hmm.
In step number 6, it's entitled Embrace Your Process. And here you're going to learn to see how your path is a process. One of the difficulties in our society, mm-hmm. is we can often become very results obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
And look, results are important, don't get me wrong, but they are not everything. And when you see what you're doing as a process, then and by process I mean that there's going to be disappointments along the way, there's going to be obstacles,
mm-hmm.
and if you can turn them into opportunities, they're invaluable for your journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, earlier in our call, you asked me about how I wrote this book, and I can tell you that it was not a linear process, and I got a ton of rejections to the manuscript, mm-hmm. a ton of them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I tried to do is just learn. Each time someone rejected the manuscript, I tried to understand a little bit more about why it was rejected. And I wasn't thrilled every time it was rejected, but I also just, it became additional fuel to move the manuscript forward.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's, you know, besides play, which is key, if there's one other thing in this book that I really want readers to take away, is the idea of process, that their journeys are going to be filled with obstacles. There's just no way, no two ways about it. But if you look at them, these obstacles, in another way, that they are just opportunities to help you along your path, that's really invaluable for the journey.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very interesting. One of the things that I like about what you have in the book, before you continue to step number 7, which is a wonderful step, by the way, but what I like you have in your book is the fact that you got all these quizzes that helps people to find clarity in what they're looking for. Because many times when we encounter the situation like we talk about now, where am I at right now and where I would like to go, gee, I know I want to get there, but I really don't know the now. I do and I don't. And what your book offers, all these wonderful quizzes that you can take, something very simple and yet very profound, and it clears things up, and obviously it helps you to have that tremendous amount of clarity on where you need to be heading to.
Thanks, Johnny. You know, the other thing, I appreciate that, and a lot of people really have been commenting to me about how they really like the quizzes,
mm-hmm.
that are in the book, because that they're not so conventional, that
mm-hmm.
the questions try to get you to think a little bit differently. And it's also an engaging process. My goal is to engage readers, to get them involved in their own process. And by taking a little quiz, you know, 3 questions
mm-hmm,
here, 4
mm-hmm.
questions there, they're already taking action. And then you can propel that action to doing more things.
Mm-hmm. Very true. So step 7, that's the interesting step, defeating the 3-headed monster. And I love that.
The 3-headed monster, which I call it, is passivity, procrastination, and perfectionism. And each of these things, passivity, just, you know, feeling
mm-hmm.
stuck and having difficulty moving forward, procrastination, putting things off until later, and perfectionism are all different devices that the inner critic uses to keep you, you know, where you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are different techniques that I use, again, first to get people moving forward, second to avoid procrastinating, and finally to give up the notion of perfectionism, because there is no such thing, you know, in our lives, in our daily lives, as perfection. There is excellence, and
mm-hmm.
there is the pursuit of excellence, but a lot of times we get wrapped up in the idea that something needs to be quote-unquote perfect, and if it's not perfect, we don't want to do it.
Right.
And I couldn't, you know, I often rail against perfectionism in my own practice, because I think that it's really about what can you do. Yeah, maybe it's not going to be perfect, but what can you do to push yourself and your own process forward?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the last 3 steps, step number 8 is reclaiming your inner hero. And this is really where you learn to value yourself. Everybody has gifts. Everybody has things that are special about them, and the key is, how do you value them? How do you use them? And how do you believe in them in order to put yourself back at the center of your own life? And that's really, you know, again, a key part of the process, because once you've gotten rid of, or at least quieted down, your inner critic, the next question is, okay, well, what's going to replace that voice? And I encourage people to replace it with their own natural inner hero.
Mm-hmm.
And step nine is where, sort of paradoxically, one of the keys to getting to your next big thing is living in the now. Because it's very hard in this, in our modern time, to sort of be in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're all distracted. We all have all sorts of demands on our time and our energy. And if we're not present, if we're not exactly where we are, both mentally, physically, and spiritually, then it's very hard to move forward. And so that step number nine is really about bringing you into the now. And I have a number of different exercises that I use to help people, you know, center themselves in the now. And that part of the journey. And finally, the last step, which I alluded to earlier, is about sharing yourself. When you are feeling full, and even if you're not feeling full, sharing yourself with other people is essential, an essential part of the journey. And, you know, there's a Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, used to say, if you wish to experience peace, provide peace for another. And sharing yourself with other people gives a bounty for you and for them, which is why that's the last part of the journey to your next big thing.
Very interesting. That ties as well into self-love, don't you think? If you feel confident within yourself, then you just have this wonderful energy that exudes out of you of wanting to share the experience that you have just encountered.
That's right. And self-love, I'm glad that you brought that up. Self-love is often one of these things that gets mistaken for narcissism. Narcissism couldn't be further from the idea of self-love. Self-love is really knowing what you are, appreciating what you are, and wanting to share that with other people in a very genuine way. Someone that loves themselves is not self-aggrandizing. They don't trample on other people. They don't ignore others. If anything, they spend their lives in service of other people, whereas people that are narcissists, it's the opposite. It's about the world serving them, and they're often loud and boisterous, and they tend to ignore other people's needs and wants, and they don't have the empathy for other people. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. I mean, the step number eight in your next big thing, which is reclaim your inner hero, really involves self-love, learning to love yourself.
And that ties as well into the fact that it's building your self-esteem and increasing your self-confidence.
And that's and the way you do that is with experience and learning to, you know, for example, let's say something doesn't work out as you hope it does. Not taking that to mean that there's something wrong with you, but looking at it as an opportunity to be like, okay, what was this about? What happened here? And how can I improve on it for next time? And if you keep that approach towards your life, you're going to succeed in achieving whatever it is that's important to you over time, because you're going to keep trying. And, you know, as we all know, you know, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. So if you keep plugging away at things and say, okay, I just want to learn from this and keep going, and taking the approach of either you win or you learn, it's going to work out for you, guaranteed.
Right. Very true. How does someone define their true purpose in life? I know you had mentioned briefly about that in one of the steps, but this is critical because this, to me, set the pace on truly what the future vision is going to be.
And this, in many ways, is what I was talking about earlier with regard to values, and which is why values play such an important role in the book, Your Next Big Thing, because your values really, they come from your family of origin, they come from your culture of origin, they come from your peer group, but all, of course, you know, your own personality, but you know, and I have a list in this chapter on knowing yourself, a list of 42 different types of values that a person can have. And of course, there are well more than that. I just give these examples. But knowing what your values are allows you to live a life in line with those values. And I have a number of different examples leading from people's values mm-hmm. to their statements of purpose. Mm-hmm. So in that chapter where people are working on discovering their purpose, I give examples from my own practice of people. One woman I worked with who, you know, her values really had to do with teaching children. And so her mm-hmm. her personal statement of purpose had to do with teaching. And another one was with an entrepreneur I worked with, you know, who believed in the power of technology, and specifically, you know, for his life. Mm-hmm. And another person I worked with whose values had to do with family, another one which had to do with faith, another yeah. one who had to work with the government. So there are, getting in touch with your values is the key to knowing what your purpose is in life.
I agree. Our goals may change over time, but our values doesn't. I believe that they just go through a process of refinement over the years.
Well put. You know, I love the way you put that, because I often talk in my practice with people about the process of distillation,
yeah.
that we're distilling our values down as we live our lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, distillation and refinement, the same, you know, they're synonyms, obviously. So I think that's well put.
Yeah, yeah. And it ties into, like you're talking about, a purpose in life, because each and every one of us have our upper and lower limits, which by definition is our comfort zone. As we address those issues, and in your book you talk about what is your personal legacy that you want to live, I mean, for someone else. And so that's important, because in a nutshell, regardless of what role that you play, your book addressed that, obviously, because you have to know what roles are you at right now and where you're going to be at and so forth. But ultimately, plain old simple question, how do you want to be remembered?
Right. And that's, you know, getting you, your mind to stretch far. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples I gave in my book, which was from a woman that I worked with who hadn't thought about this question. And as we began to work together, she discovered that she decided that she really wanted to make a piece of jewelry that mm-hmm. her great-great-granddaughter could wear to her senior prom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that started her on a journey of being able to make jewelry, which she hadn't even thought about. She used to play with beads and things like that when, you know, about more than 20 years prior. Mm-hmm. And it started her on a whole new path and a whole new career.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of getting you to open your mind, both in terms of time and space, and thinking about how you want to be remembered is a really, it's one of the exercises to get people thinking about their next big thing.
Right. It's all about possibilities.
That's right.
Wonderful. So what are the major challenges people face when they go through the process of making this paradigm shift in their lifestyle?
I think that the first one, is, as I alluded to before, is the idea of the inner critic. And, mm-hmm. and the inner critic really comes from, again, a lot of voices of people and situations that told you basically no, or you can't do this. And we often internalize those lessons because we don't, you know, because of feelings of shame or fear or embarrassment. And being able to face that part of ourselves is absolutely essential for getting to your next big thing. So, and that chapter in and of itself is really, there's a lot of exercises trying to get you to get in touch with that voice and to separate it so you don't think it's all of you, but realizing it's only part of you.
Mm-hmm.
But the other things, and these are more practical matters, mm-hmm. have to do with time and when are you going to fit this in, and, you know, everyone, most people work for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really do break this out for people in terms of looking at their weekly schedule and finding little blocks of time, a half an hour here, even less here or there, to get started, because we often fall into the trap of saying, oh, I'm going to work on it over the summer, or I'm going to work on it when I retire. And that I couldn't discourage that more, because oftentimes when we have these large blocks of time, mm-hmm. we don't use them as effectively as if we have 20 minutes in between appointments where we can actually jot down some ideas. And so it's looking for the little cracks in our schedule and that we can use to take action on our next big thing.
That's interesting, though, because you're talking about more of quality time versus quantity.
Absolutely. You know, I was talking to my mother-in-law, who is a teacher, and she is about to retire. And she told me she was reading the book, and it got her pretty excited about wanting to start a project that she'd been thinking about for a while. Mm-hmm. And she said, right when I retire, I'm going to do this. And I said, no. Don't wait. Do it now when you have free time, you know, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, because then you'll be moving. But if you put it off until you have these large blocks of time, I actually think it's quite overwhelming to have large blocks of time that are unstructured. And so when you get to those large blocks of time, if you've actually put some work towards your next big thing, it'll pay off.
Yeah. And that's part of the idea, again, don't get caught up with the idea of having a perfect time to do it, because the moment you think about it, take action. It doesn't matter how big or small, but just get going.
That's right. And everyone has different things in terms of their ideal time.
Right.
You know, I work with a lot of folks that are in more traditionally creative fields. And, for example, one writer that I work with only writes in the morning. He gets up, he sits at his desk, he shuts everything out, he writes for a few hours. That's when he's most fertile. And another writer who I work with literally only works in the wee hours of the morning at like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And so knowing yourself and knowing how you work and how you like to do things is key for finding the time and making the time and creating the time for your next big thing.
Well, the biggest thing also, don't misunderstand perfectionism with routine and regimen, because those are two different things. A lot of times people get caught up with being perfect. You want to make sure everything is perfect, but that's different than being able to have a routine, a little regimen that you put out together. Even those authors writing at the wee hours of the morning or first thing in the morning, it doesn't matter whether they have their creative juices going, they will just sit there and start writing.
That's right. Routine can be extremely helpful as long as we don't feel confined by it.
Right. And that brings me to the fact that your book shows extensive and very elaborate management of one's calendar. How important is that?
You know, you have to realize I'm a New Yorker. But I actually do think that if we take the idea, I remember I learned this lesson when I was in sixth grade. I'll never forget this. One of my teachers told a story about a man who wasted no time, and he gave these examples of how this guy would use every minute of every day. Now that may be an extreme example, but it stayed with me, and I really try to live that and encourage that by having these sort of examples and schedules in the book, because everyone feels like we don't have enough time, but if you look for the little windows here or there, you try to push it. There's more time in the day than we may recognize. If it's there, if we look for it and we need it.
Right. What is interesting about when you do that little exercise, you find out how much time you waste. It's quite
absolutely
the opposite. Yeah, it's not so much how productive you are, it's how much unproductive time you have at hand that seems to kind of slide away without you even knowing it.
That's right. And so just making yourself conscious of that, I think, is really important.
Which one of the 10 steps is the most difficult one that you have encountered among the people that you have shared this process with?
That's a great question, Johnny. And I have to say, I mean, it obviously varies for different people, but by and large, I think that the most difficult one is facing your inner critic. Because a lot of times when you have been laboring under the thumb of an inner critic, you can begin to think that your inner critic is just you. And you don't even realize that it's just a part of you. And so the idea of facing that voice and realizing that this is not all of you is very difficult. And people's inner critics are, you know, different. And some of them are stronger, and some of them are not as strong. But facing that part of you that says, no, you can't do it, or you shouldn't do it, I find that's the part of the process that people tend to, when I'm speaking at different events, that's often the thing that people come up to me and talk most about, is the difficulty of facing their inner critic.
Well, then you are invalidating yourself. I think that's a great challenge in terms of, you know, it forces you to go into denial most of the time.
That's right. And a lot of times, if the inner critic has been running the show for a long time, it can often bring up feelings of regret.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
people saying, well, why didn't I do this 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And the reality is, I don't believe in regret. You are where you are, and you can you get lessons when you're ready for your mind to hear them.
Right.
So if you look back and say, oh, I wish I had, and it's like, no. This is where you are now. Let's move forward.
That's true. So basically, it's no time is the right time. Any time is the right time.
That's right, Johnny. That's exactly right.
Very interesting. Can you share with us some of your clients' success stories?
Well, one of the things that we often can get anchored to is success mm-hmm. as an external thing.
Right.
So successes that other people see. And we often can forget that there is all sorts of, there's many different types of success. You know, for example, I worked with this one writer a long time ago who had actually finished his manuscript for his book, his first book, before he met with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that when I first started working with him, but he was working for a company where his boss had a lot of success as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he had offhandedly told his boss that he'd had a completed manuscript, but didn't want to share it with his boss because he was afraid to. He was afraid of his boss saying that he wasn't good or what have you. And what ended up happening was that he ended up sharing it with his boss and didn't see that as a victory. That the idea of his own triumph over fear of just giving the manuscript to his boss, he was so focused on his boss's reaction that he didn't even realize that he had scored a tremendous victory for himself just by giving his boss the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out his boss really liked the manuscript, but his boss didn't get back to him right away, and so he was really stricken by fear during that period of time.
Very interesting. Basically, also one of the worst things that can happen in terms of if you're giving in to your inner critics is the process of self-inflicted anxiety.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I talk about in your next big thing is this idea of anxiety as being this mechanism by which we leave the present
mm-hmm.
and we project ourselves into an uncertain future
mm-hmm.
that is unfair and it's inappropriate because something really magical happens
mm-hmm.
when we're faced with real difficulty. And in that moment, we often exceed our expectations, but a lot of times it's the run-up to that difficulty that is the worst part, the unknown.
Very interesting. Your book not only addressed the fact that you have to be playful and, of course, defining the purpose in life. You talk, interestingly enough, about work. And a lot of times when we talk about work, it's that heavy burden. Oh, my God, I have to work. I have to do this. I have to do that. But the way you have done it, the way you explain work being a good thing is very interesting. So please share that with us, on how work can be a really good thing in the pursuit of your next big thing.
Most of the times when people think about work, they think about the jobs that they're doing usually for someone else, you know, where they're getting mm-hmm. paid to do something. And those tasks are often laid out in front of you. And they can be rewarding in certain ways, or they can not be rewarding, or they could be a pain, or what have you. But when you're working towards your next big thing, you're working for you.
Mm-hmm.
You are the boss, and you get the grime, and you get the glory. And the idea of working towards something that has meaning for you individually
mm-hmm.
is, once you're doing it, it really is much more fulfilling than the way we tend to think about work in a conventional sense, like I'm working my 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
It's really about bringing that that energy force of you and bringing it forward in life.
Very interesting. What advice do you have for people who are still on the sideline and not ready to take the plunge?
Well, the first thing is recognizing that any action is almost always better than no action. So just doing anything is important. So if you're not – oftentimes I find that people sort of get in a rut because they're just not sure what is the quote-unquote right action to take.
Mm-hmm.
But any action has value. And so even if it's the smallest thing, 5 minutes towards imagining a new future is 5 minutes that you didn't spend before. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is start from where you are, not from where you maybe want to be or think that you are, but really taking stock, which is part of, again, why in your next big thing, I encourage people to know who they are and spend some time there. Because, you know, I once worked with a man who decided that he really wanted to go out on his own and be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And he became actually quite angry. I talk about him a bit in the book. He became quite angry and resentful that he thought I was encouraging him to quit his job and start on his own. And I said, no, that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You just take one step toward, because that's not where he was. He wasn't at a point where he could quit his job. He needed to support himself. But if you could just take one step towards your next big thing, you'll find that it gets easier with every step that you take.
That's very true. Well, we're still barely starting out 2013, and of course this coming weekend will be a start of a new year for the folks who celebrate the Lunar New Year, the Chinese New Year, and so forth. So just about the rest of Asia and elsewhere, pretty much the New Year is just about to get started. And I think the very one thing that people can do, if nothing else, I believe you offer this on your website, and of course the thing that you do, you talk best in your book, is that take a little quiz about, are you running in place? I think that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you'll know, do you need to take the plunge or not?
Mm-hmm. Again, that's a lot of those quizzes are, throughout the book, but at the beginning of the book especially, are there to help people just sort of ground themselves in where they are. And I'm glad that you brought up the fact that it's Chinese New Year this coming Sunday, and it's a great time to reevaluate where you are. And I don't believe in New Year's resolutions. I really don't, because most of the time, as we know, they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe in making commitments, and committing to yourself and committing to your loved ones or who's important to you to do more, to be better, to live bolder is a much stronger and more useful way of considering change.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading your next big thing?
Well, the key things, I think, are, again, knowing their sense of play, reconnecting with their sense of play, identifying their purpose in life, and then working towards that. And if they can have a more fluid sense of their path in life, that it's not a straight road, I think that people will be better served in that regard. So the three elements that underscore most of my work are play, purpose, and work. And if people can get closer to their natural sense of play, identify with their higher sense of purpose, and start working towards those things, they will be extremely well served. And I will feel like, you know, I did something, you know, hopefully good by sharing some of these ideas with people.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about play, work, and purpose, when it's all said and done, it's about having fun. Life is too short. You want to go out there and have fun, and you want to do something meaningful. And then what are you leaving behind for others to talk about in a positive way?
I couldn't have said it better myself, Johnny. That's if you go, you know, and you seem like you really embody that, but if you have those feelings in your life and you're out there looking at the world as opposed to something you have to do, but something you get to do,
right,
then that's a great way of going through life. And again, even with all the obstacles that come people's way.
Yeah, very true. So where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
So the book is available wherever books are sold. It's on Amazon.com. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. It's on IndieBound. as well as, you know, any of the online retailers, as well as most bookstores that are out there. You can get the book in ebook version, or you can get the hardcover version. And I have my, you know, my own website is Dr. Ben Michaelis, drbenmichaelis.com. And I also write for the Huffington Post, so I have a blog, an active blog there, as well as psychologytoday.com. And so any of those places are good venues. And I love to hear from people, so please have people feel free to reach out. I love to hear how people are experiencing the work.
By the way, your blogs are wonderful. I mean, it gets to the point, precise, crisp. It's a wonderful read.
Thank you. Thanks, Johnny. You know, the article that I wrote, you know, just last week, entitled "What Does It Mean to Be Smart," has really been one of the, I feel like, one of the more impactful things I've written. It's been shared through, you know, been shared a fair amount on the internet. It's generated a lot of discussion, because I often think that we get into these ruts where we think that only certain people that quote unquote make the grade are smart, and I really reject that notion. That I think that a lot of it has to do with your particular circumstances and how you're adapting to your own life.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about basically what I consider as intellectual knowledge and intellectual wisdom. That's two different things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that wisdom and living your life in terms of, you know, your higher purpose and seeing yourself as having a path and moving along that path is about wisdom. Whereas a lot of times, sort of the momentary knowledge or being able to store things in memory is really about, you know, quote unquote, what we tend to think of as smart.
Very true. How can someone walk straight ahead and not look back?
Great question. Oftentimes, when people first come to see me, they ask me, how can I get over my past? How can I put this behind me? And my response is, I don't want you to put anything behind you. If something's behind you, it can always sneak up on you. And so you don't want to put anything behind you. You want to know where your challenges are. And so working through a process like in Your Next Big Thing, where we take you through a journey from knowing yourself to facing your inner critic, to discovering your purpose, all that is about bringing all of these parts of you forward into the now. And when you do that, then you can move forward. But I do think that it does require a little bit of that digging around and looking where you've gotten to in your journey in order to move forward.
Interesting. Can you share with us the three strategies of living in now?
Sure. The three strategies of living in the now really, you mean my exercises in that way?
Yes, yes.
Okay, sure. So one of the exercises that I suggest in the book just involves people checking in with their five senses. And I have a sort of a guided meditation in the book where I walk people through the five senses so that they can ground themselves into the now. And I always start this exercise with sense of smell, the olfactory sense, because it is our strongest and most primitive sense, and it can stop us from spiraling, you know, in terms of anxiety or depression. So going through the five senses, from the olfactory sense, to hearing, to taste, to touch, to seeing, it's one way of bringing you into the now. And there's, you know, there's other ones as well, one of which is getting people to just talk about and think about things that they can see in their immediate circumstances. So that's really grounding them physically and mentally in the now. And the other one is that if you're having difficulty because you're having intrusive thoughts, listen to those thoughts for a moment. Try to acknowledge them, honor them, and commit the time to deal with those thoughts at a later date. Those are three different ways of considering when you're having intrusive thoughts that are getting you away from now. So listen, acknowledge, and commit the time to dealing with them at a later date. Those things can allow you to get rid of those intrusive thoughts and bring you into the now.
Very true. That's very exciting. How has writing Your Next Big Thing impacted you personally?
It's been quite rewarding to hear from people that have read the book and felt connected to it. I've had a couple of people reach out to me via email telling me about how it's changed the way they want to think about their life and what they're going to do in their lives. Two particular folks, two different attorneys actually reached out to me and said, hey, look, reading your book has just had me going on a brand new trajectory in life. And, you know, just being, it's just been really rewarding to get people's stories and how the work has impacted them, because that's really what I want to do. I wanted to do it to share something with other people, and getting other people's feedback has been incredibly rewarding for me.
Well, your book ties into the fact that you have your feelings affects your thought process. And I think that's very important, because a lot of times when you talk about books, when I say like yours, not necessarily exactly like yours, but along those lines of what are we planning for the future, it tends to be very dry. And in reading your book, there's a lot of soul in it, and that makes a big difference, because I think it really connects with people on the inside.
That's great to hear, and that was the point. So I'm glad that comes through in reading it. And, you know, the one thing that I have heard is that my voice comes through in the book, that it sounds like, for people that know me, it sounds like the way I talk.
Yeah.
To me, that's really gratifying, because if I've been able to get across some of how I am, my essence in the book, then, you know, then I feel like I've sort of done the job in that way. I hope that it speaks to people.
Well, that's wonderful. So, by the way, when you read the book, you've met Dr. Michaelis. How's that?
There you go.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
I do. You know, I alluded to this earlier, that these three different elements that underlie all of my thinking, which are play, purpose, and work. And if you can live a life that involves dreaming up possibilities and imagining new horizons and connecting with your higher purpose that gives you meaning, and then putting some effort towards getting to where you want to go, then in my mind, that's a life and a recipe for balance in life. And people often talk about a work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the barriers need to be drawn with such strong markers, that you can, if you bring your essence into your work, and you bring your sense of play into work, and you bring your sense of pushing forward into your personal life, then you can live a life of balance, even if it's not balanced necessarily in terms of hours.
Right.
It's balanced in terms of your spirit and your soul.
Very interesting. That's a beautiful recipe for living. What is next for you?
Well, you know, I've been doing a bunch of speaking, which has been really, really enjoyable. I was speaking in the Oklahoma Creativity Forum a couple of months ago, and been doing a course for people who are on the verge of retiring out in the College of St. Elizabeth in New Jersey over the summer, and I'm going to be doing a workshop with a yoga instructor out in Los Angeles next month. So I've been sort of having the opportunity to spread the word a little bit before, you know, kind of going back and probably writing another one.
You founded a nonprofit organization in New York, am I correct?
Well, it's working with different clinicians who are, in order to connect them, in order to provide better care for our patients.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called the Downtown Clinicians Collective, and it's an organization. You could, you know, Google us, it's downtownclinicians.com, for clinicians of all different disciplines working in and around New York City, allowing people to connect with one another, to talk about patient care, and also to, you know, just increase the dialogue among local clinicians.
How's that coming in terms of the magnitude of it, and how many people have you guys really make an impact on?
Well, we've been in operation since 2008, and right now we have almost 400 members, 400 clinicians. And if you figure that, you know, each clinician works with somewhere between maybe 20 and 40 people, you know, you have to figure, you know, it's impacting tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
And so it's really been very rewarding to have that organization, and we continue to meet on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Right here downtown Manhattan, and sometimes in other locations since we've expanded so much. But it's been great to have all that dialogue and getting to know different people in different fields.
Very interesting. Any final words about your next big thing?
Yeah, I think that since I have your ear and I hopefully have your listeners' ears, the things that I really would like to share, if I can leave one thing with people, which is to remember that there's never been anyone like you, nor can there or will there ever be in this world. And to make the most of the miracle of you by living a life filled with play, purpose, and work, and to give of yourself without losing yourself, and sharing of yourself, because what you share comes back to you in riches greater than you can possibly imagine.
Very interesting. That's the essence of your entire book.
It is. It really is.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. Dr. Michaelis, thank you for the great recipe for living that you had shared with us earlier and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning for a special Valentine's Day broadcast. My guest will be relationship and love expert Carrie Valentine. Carrie and I will be discussing about his upcoming book titled In Love Forever, 7 Secrets to a Joyous and Juicy Relationship. Carrie will be revealing ways to create an affair with your loved one that would provide the pleasure and love that lasts a lifetime. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Michaelis, thank you again and have a blessed day.
You too, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.